the state of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Associate Chief Justice Kadish presiding.
Morning, everyone. Go ahead and have a seat. So, Chief Justice Stiglitz was unable to be here in person today, but she is listening to the arguments, and she will be participating in the cases that we have on calendar today. So, first up, we have case number 82014, in re the DOT litigation, which we did extend the time on for 40 minutes. Do you want to go ahead and let us know how you're dividing the time, or if you're dividing the time?
Yes, good morning, Justices. We have discussed, we have 20 minutes. I would like to use as an opening on behalf of TGIG plaintiffs, 13 minutes. And turn over for 5 minutes to counsel, who also will be arguing on respective positions. That would be 2 minutes for me for rebuttal, plus any time they choose not to use during their time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And for you, just time-wise.
Good morning, Justice Todd Weiss. Yes, we're going to, I'm going to use the first 7 minutes to focus on the standing issues, and then Mr. Hone is going to have just a brief joinder, and then we will turn it over to Mr. Ireland to use the remainder of the time on behalf of the state.
Okay, thank you. All right, then, with that, are you ready to proceed? You know, I should say, so I guess it's 2 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll put the yellow light on at the 2 minutes, but the time keeps running. So it'll be up to you to break when you're ready to break, in other words, to transfer to different counsel and have them come up. So, and it's up to you to stop with enough time to have time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
With that, you may proceed.
Again, good morning, Justices. My name is Mark Zarnowski. I'm the law firm of Clark Hill, and I am representing the interests of the appellants, the TGIG plaintiffs, in connection with this matter. Justices, despite the fact that you all are sitting up there, we have a group of fine lawyers sitting down here, I do believe we have something that we share in common. And that is, from our first day of law school, we had ingrained in us a fundamental principle of law. And that principle of law was that for every wrong, there is a remedy. And in fact, we were taught, and what I've learned over the course of 40 years since I graduated law school, is that not only is this a fundamental principle of English common law and American jurisprudence, but it also is foundational to the social contract that we as a free people have given consent to be governed by someone else. And that foundational principle is that if the government takes an action that harms our rights, then the social contract, the social compact is that we've given up our freedom in order for the judicial system to remedy the wrong, because the government quite simply is not allowed to arbitrarily and capriciously take away our rights. And if that principle is denied, the very fabric of our society is somewhat torn apart. There's no reason for us to give a right and a consent to be governed unless we are to be protected in our rights. But yet the Department of Taxation in this case, and the intervening defendants in this case, and sadly the district court in this case, have modified that fundamental principle that guides our society. And they've changed it in such a way where they want you to sustain that the foundational principle is If the government violates the constitutional rights of all similarly situated people equally, then none of the people whose rights have been violated have any recourse or any redress. In other words, they're basically stating that...
All right. Mr. Zarnowski, so what constitutional rights of your clients were violated?
The constitutional rights that were violated by our client was the due process clause of both the United States Constitution and the Nevada State Constitution. Mm-hmm. And the big elephant in the room with respect to answering that question is that the evidence in this case has established conclusively that fully 70% of the licenses that were awarded to applicants in the relevant application process were awarded to applicants who failed to submit complete applications during the application period. And what happened was, despite regulations that were duly enacted that addressed and told the DOT what they had to do, effectively, the DOT simply waived these regulatory requirements on their own without submitting any modifications, amendments, changes to the existing regulations that supposedly guided them.
Mr. Zarnowski, but in terms of that, is there any evidence that was presented below to show that the appellants actually themselves submitted complete applications?
I'm sorry, that they actually did what?
The appellants themselves had completed applications. There was nothing in the record that I could see that showed that the actual appellants themselves complied with the requirements and completed the, everything was heavily redacted, save and except one appellant. And so we weren't able to see whether or not the applications of the appellants who are now supposedly aggrieved, they themselves submitted complete applications.
Well, you are correct. Because of the way this record was done, and the fact of the matter is that the applications were so heavily redacted for everyone, that we really weren't able to do that kind of analysis. But I need to tell you that the answer to your question makes no difference to the outcome of this case. And the trap that the defendants have set, I think, throughout, and you're going to hear, I expect, another 20 minutes of the same argument, is that because my clients could not prove an entitlement to a license, or that their applications were complete, or something of that nature, therefore, they can't have standing and they weren't injured in this matter. But what they're trying to convince you, and they tried to convince the district court, and they've tried for years to do, is to mischaracterize the injury that we're claiming. Our injury doesn't stem from the denial of a license. I want to make that absolutely clear. We don't have to prove that we would have gotten a license. Our property interest is not in the license itself. Our property interest that we claim was violated is the right to a market share. And that right to, and whether or not the market share that our clients had built and earned through years of developing their dispensary locations and developing their business and their clientele, all of that work and effort led to them having a specific market share for the sale of marijuana in their respective jurisdictions.
But medical marijuana, correct?
No. Yes. And then,
right. And so what is, how do you extrapolate that to then? It seems a bit speculative to say then you would have a guaranteed market share of the recreational space. I mean, is that... I mean, and so is it speculative to say that you guys were denied a market share?
I think I misspoke. The initial licensing was for medical licenses. Then there was a process why some marijuana retail licenses were issued. And then came this application period. and we are focused on the application period. My clients were engaged, my recollection, in retail dispensary operations. All of these, the applicants that I represent had existing businesses selling retail marijuana.
So are you claiming a right to market share in the medical marijuana space or in the recreational marijuana space?
Well, they had a market share in the retail marijuana space as well as medical.
So can you answer my question, though?
I'm sorry. I thought
medical. Are you saying a market right to a market share as to medical marijuana or as to recreational marijuana or both? What are you claiming?
Recreational.
So you're saying you're not claiming that you had a right to get a license, but you do have a right to a particular market share of recreational marijuana?
We have a right not to a specific market share. This is where it gets a little bit convoluted. What we have a right is not to have that market share taken away from us by arbitrary and capricious action by the government.
How can you have something taken away that you never had?
Well, they did have a market share.
Not of recreational marijuana.
Let me give you an example. Let's say, just for the sake of math, because it makes it easier, say that there were two retail marijuana dispensaries operating in Clark County. There were only two licenses. And somehow or other, all of the legal marijuana sales would then be made to these two dispensaries. They split the market share. 100% of the market share is owned by two people. Well, now, I mean, just common sense, as well as our expert testimony, if all of a sudden you issue 10 new licenses and you have 10 new competitors walk into your environment where there was only two before, now you're competing against 12 licensees and your market share, wherever it was, is going to be decreased because of that additional competition. Now, there's nothing wrong with
that. Let me pause you for a minute. Judge Gonzalez expressly found that the claim for loss of market share is too speculative for relief. And what it strikes me that finding should be entitled to some deference by us. So wouldn't you say the burden is on you to demonstrate otherwise?
Well, I think the important aspect of answering your question is it depends on whether you're seeking monetary relief or equitable relief in this case. Because the fact of the matter is, the issue of damage to the market share, the fact of damage, was proven at this trial. And I think just using the example that I gave you, I don't even think we needed experts to tell you the truth. If you issue 10 new licenses, we're only two existed before, you're going to have a loss of market share. But we brought on expert witnesses to talk about this. And what they said was that we were unable not to say that market share was negatively impacted, but we couldn't tell you, quantify a monetary amount of damage that arose from a market share diminution. And why is that the case? The reason that was the case is because of the arbitrary and capricious action by the state, which waived the regulatory requirement for the applicants to list the proposed business location.
You're conceding that you're not riding the horse that you had an entitlement to a license, right, on recreational marijuana.
We did not have an entitlement to a license.
And you're conceding that these licenses are for recreational marijuana, obviously.
Yes.
How can you have a market share that is non-speculative when you don't have a license or an entitlement to a license to that market?
We were operating with dispensary licenses in the retail.
But as a medical license?
As well as a recreational.
Okay.
Wait, what? How is that possible? I don't understand what you just said.
My recollection as I'm standing here right now, Justice Kavish, is that medical marijuana licenses had initially been issued. Then there is a period of time where those licensees were granted preference.
I thought that was in the application process that this whole litigation is about. There was some temporary license for all medical marijuana license holders before this process? Is that what you're saying?
You know, as I'm sitting here right now, my recollection is they were engaged in retail dispensary operations. Now, for my rebuttal time, I am going to go double check my fact and make sure of that. I will definitely do that.
Okay.
But again, getting back to the market share versus the entitlement to the license, I'm entitled not to have my market share taken away by arbitrary and capricious actions of the state.
Hey, counsel, there was a very specific process, right? So this is all outlined in the statute in terms of what factors would be considered. The applications were submitted, then they were ranked, and none of the appellants came even close to like the top 10% of applicants. And so if they would have, let's say they did everything perfectly, how can you satisfy this notion that you guys would have gotten a license but for the absence of the address? Specifically, it's the address. I mean, I think that's where you have to designate a location. How can you satisfy the inquiry that but for the deprivation of not having the addresses is that you guys would have gotten a license? And that's your market share.
But for the issuance of the unlawful licenses, there wouldn't have been the additional competition. There wouldn't have been the 84 or 62 additional licenses issued. So whether my client would have gotten a license or not doesn't matter. The damage to the market share is because new entrants were approved unlawfully and allowed to participate. If those licenses were denied, then there wouldn't have been 64 or 62 additional competitors coming into the marketplace, and my client's market share would have been effectively the same or based upon fair competition.
But
it was the addition.
Mr. Zardowski, to make that argument, to have standing to make that argument, don't you have to be in the market collecting a share for the 64 new people to come in and potentially take away from your share? Not that you're not even in the market because you don't have a license.
We had a share of the existing market, and the additional licenses that were issued diminished that. And they were diminished in a process where the regulations, and we're missing and losing time quickly, and this is like the most critical aspect of this case is, from our standpoint, is you have regulations that were duly enacted said that the application must have the proposed location of the marijuana establishment. Mm-hmm. And that was done by regulation. And after the regulations were adopted, what we end up having happen is that somebody out there through a task, you're going to hear about task force, industry participants, the DOT itself said, this regulation that we required the proposed business location, this doesn't work for us. We think it's bad policy. So what they did is they simply waived it. One person said, waive it. We're not going to require what the regulations require to be in the application. And I raised the Accardi doctrine. I would like for one case that wasn't in our brief very quickly, because the state of Nevada, while not mentioning the Accardi doctrine itself or quoting the U.S. Ex rel Accardi case, in State Ex rel Nevada Tax Commission, the Safeway Super Service, 99 NEV 626, 668 P second 291, dealt with the similar situation dealing with motor vehicles regulation. And this court, in examining the regulations, Here's a direct quote. A properly adopted substantive rule establishes a standard of conduct which has the force of law. Rules adopted by an agency are binding on the agency until the agency repeals them or a court declares them invalid. I mean, that is clear. That is concise. New Leaf does not apply in this case, because which they will argue. New Leaf doesn't apply because New Leaf was based on ambiguity. There were no regulations defining the statute. So this court said the timing of this event was going to be it was ambiguous, and therefore what they did was fine. Here, the gap, any ambiguity in the statute was covered by the regulations that mandated something be done, and then the DOT said, never mind, it's impractical and we don't want to do it.
Mr. Zarnowski, what do we do with NRS 233B-127-1, where judicial review is not available to challenge the denial of a license unless notice and opportunity for hearing are required by law to be provided to the applicant before the grant, denial, or renewal of license? Here, I didn't see anything in the regulation where that was in the regulation itself. So is judicial review even available to your client under that statute?
Judge Gonzalez found yes, Justice. She found yes based upon some kind of a theory. I believe that it wasn't the denial of the license itself that was the contested aspect of the case. And she went ahead and said judicial review was proper. I am very well aware of a case that was authored by Justice Pickering.
The Samantha Inc. case in 2017?
There you go, the Samantha case. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you that the judicial review was properly done. Our appeal is, if a judicial review was proper, Judge Gonzalez did it improperly, and we gave you all the reasons in our brief. If you find judicial review was improper, well, then we will have to punt on that one. But I will say that that case, Samantha case, didn't say that we didn't have a remedy. And that's where we started from. It said you have a remedy for declaratory relief, equitable relief. And so the Samantha case supports the remaining aspects of our claims. And boy, my co-counselor is going to be very angry with me.
Well, I will give you an extra 2 minutes for rebuttal, and I'll do the same for the other side. So
thank
at least
you,
do you want to use the 2 minutes now or wait for a rebuttal?
I can wait.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
It's up to you. You're managing your own time.
I see two and one for rebuttal.
No. Two. Not three. Mm-hmm. Two.
Okay.
You get 2 minutes. You want them now or later?
I can take it.
Okay. Go ahead.
Good morning, Justices. Todd Weiss on behalf of Essence Tropicana and Essence Henderson. As I indicated, I intend to use 2 minutes, or I'm sorry, 7 minutes to address the principal issue, which we submit is dispositive of this case, if not all of it, certainly most of it, which is the standing question. And Mr. Zarnowski's arguments, I think, concede much of the standing problem here. There is no protected property right for constitutional purposes in a market share. Think about the proposition that they are advancing here. Because I guess as a lawyer, I would love this argument about standing, because it would be the Full Employment Act for every law firm in town that does commercial work. Because now every tavern operator who doesn't want competition, he has an existing market share. So if the government's going to approve a new tavern license for someone else, I've got standing now to challenge that. I don't think they're suitable. They sold liquor to a minor one time, so therefore they're not suitable. You shouldn't allow their licensure. Think about every gaming company in town. They don't want competition. Tell me a business that does want competition. So do they have standing now to say, well, The Gaming Control Board didn't apply the standards sufficiently when they found that licensee suitable. Therefore, I've got standing now to file a lawsuit, and let's have a trial about that person's suitability under the regulations. That cannot be the requirements of standing for this court to invoke the judicial machinery. So when they come in and they tell you, they concede that they don't have any evidence, and they presented no evidence, that they could have obtained a license under this process, that is fatal. Right there is a confession that they have no standing. And the reason that they have no standing is because they don't satisfy any of the requirements. You have to have an injury in fact, and it has to be an injury to something that the judiciary recognizes as an injury. Competition, losing market share because the government allows more competition is not a protected status. Where the government allows competition, you're now, quote, injured. I mean, do I have standing if the bar licenses more lawyers? I think they're licensing too many lawyers. I don't think that they did a good job in administering the bar exam. Do I, as a lawyer, now I have a market share. Can I challenge that under the theory that, well, they shouldn't have allowed those people to pass the bar? That's essentially their theory. Not that they would have obtained a license, as they concede that they wouldn't have. And Justice Lee, to your question, no one stopped them, being the applicants, the plaintiffs in this case, from unredacting their applications. That was their choice. They didn't want to present any evidence about their applications because they were not compliant with the very things that they are here in court complaining about. Mr. Zarnowski's client was the chief advocate for this location issue. His client didn't want there to be this location issue. He lobbied, as the evidence before the district court showed, he lobbied the state to not require this fixed location in advance.
Mr. Bryce, the standing issue is very compelling to me, but I'm wondering, should we take into consideration the problems in the application process themselves? Judge Gonzalez acknowledged and set forth all of the things that went wrong with the application process. One of them, which I'm a little concerned about, is the direct contact with Mr. Pupo that some people had and others did not. Was your client, for instance, the beneficiary of this communication with Mr. Pupo that maybe other applicants didn't have? Because there was supposed to be a single point of contact,
yes.
But there was some deviation from that. And did that create an unfair advantage to certain applicants, maybe including your own?
So as Justice Gonzalez said, at the end of the day, the answer was no, it did not have any impact. But yes, my client did employ the same lawyer that Mr. Zarnowski's clients employed.
This is Amanda Connor?
This is Ms. Connor.
Okay.
And Ms. Connor is the one who had, as they complained, had greater contact to Mr. Pupo than some of the others. But
did her clients obtain licenses at a greater rate than
no, actually
other applicants?
Right, no. And in fact, this was one of the points that we got their own expert to admit, is that TGIG had the far greatest contact with Mr. Pupo and as the party that did not get licenses. That was, and their expert admitted on the stand, that was proof in and of itself that the process worked. So the answer to your question, Justice Lee, is no. And here's the reality. Anytime you're going to have a big process like this, this was the first time, right, that they were doing it this way. There are going to be, in hindsight, people are always going to be able to point at some issue and say, well, that could have been done differently. That could have been done differently. I mean, we all know that as lawyers when we handle cases. Upon reflection, we could have done things differently during the entire case. And that's no different than what the state learned through this process. So no, there is no basis for the judiciary to now set it aside. Even when the district court who heard the evidence said, all these issues that did occur, that the district court took some issue with, conceded at the end of the day, they didn't matter. All right. So I think I've used up the time that I have allotted. I'm going to turn this over now to Mr. Ireland, but my point would simply be, again, the court should not recognize standing for these types of a claim, because if it does,
Before you sit down, let me ask you this question. What do you think Judge Gonzalez ruled on that issue? Because in her phase one findings of fact and conclusions of law, she addressed all the law on standing, but never says whether they're standing or not. She just rolls into plaintiffs didn't, you know, meet their burden.
Well, I was a broken record in front of the district judge on that issue about standing. And we briefed it, raised it with her several times. And at the end of the day, I agree, Justice Hernan, she never actually answered the question.
Okay.
But she seems to have assumed that there was standing because she did then proceed to address the underlying merits, which is, I would assume, was a finding by her that they had standing. But the only standing, as they admit, would be this market share theory, which cannot be a legally protected interest. It just can't be, because if it is, every business competitor now has standing to challenge the licensing by the government of their competitors. I thank the court for its time.
Thanks. Good morning, Justices. Eric Hone on behalf of Respondent Lone Mountain Partners. We join in the argument of Mr. Bice and the Essence entities. Our positions are directly aligned in that regard. Unless there are no questions directly related to Lone Mountain Partners, I will cede my time to Mr. Ireland.
Good morning. May it please the court. Keel Ireland on behalf of the state. And I'd like to start with the issue that Justice Lee ended my friend on the other side's argument with, which is whether a petition for judicial review under the Nevada APA is available. The district court actually did address this in the phase one findings of fact and conclusions of law. And she acknowledged that under this court's Samantha decision, there is no petition for judicial review available because the statute establishing this licensing process did not allow for notice and a hearing. And that's in footnote 16 on page 46,826 of the record. So that was an alternative grounds for denying the phase one claims. But that still, of course, leaves the constitutional claims, the phase two claims. And I think there's been some confusion about what the standard for that is. My friend on the other side keeps talking about arbitrary and capricious, whether these issues made the whole licensing process arbitrary and capricious. But that's the APA standard. That's not the constitutional standard. And to apply that here would be to constitutionalize every administrative challenge of any process that the state undergoes. And that's just not how the Nevada or the U.S. Constitution works. We have separate ways of challenging different things. And if there's something really bad, then the Constitution comes into play. But ordinary administrative challenges, that's arbitrary and capricious. So the standard for a constitutional violation is it has to be an intentional, where there's no, like here, there's no fundamental right at issue, and there's no protected class, it has to be an intentional act without a rational basis. And plaintiffs have just not pointed to any act by the agency that was without a rational basis. For example, the deletion of the address requirement was based on industry feedback after the first application went out, that it didn't make sense with the timing because really it's localities that approved the location. And the state approves whether the operations would be effective, whether the business is well capitalized enough to be granted a license. It didn't make sense to tie those two things together, so that was deleted.
And is it true that ultimately, because they were granted provisional licenses preliminarily, that in order to get final approval, they had to actually show zoning, location, and all of those things to get final approval?
Yes, exactly. So okay. The location was only deleted at the front end with the initial application. And in any case, the address was not a scored section. All the floor plan and that kind of thing was non-identified. So it wasn't necessarily tied to a particular address anyway. And of course, they would have to have a physical address in order to be finally licensed and be able to operate permanently. So we may disagree with whether deleting this requirement was the right thing to do or not, but that doesn't mean it lacked a rational basis. Mm-hmm. Rational basis is the most deferential standard of review we have.
To the extent that their claim is a due process claim as opposed to an equal protection claim, they may be making that as well, but focus on due process. If they're deprived of due process, I guess, how does the rational basis test apply in that context? I guess I think of that more in equal protection.
Yeah, it applies to both, Your Honor. For substantive due process claims, it's basically the same as equal protection. Let's say a class of one equal protection claim. So if there was a fundamental right, then it would be strict scrutiny or something like that. But in this case, there is no fundamental right. It's a license that they were applying for.
Thank you. Yep.
And in terms of scoring, did Mr. Pupo have any independent ability outside of the objective metrics that were set forth in the regulations to deviate and weigh more favorably certain applicants because they had had individual contact with him versus the single point of contact?
Absolutely not. He had no role in the scoring. It was completely independent. They used independent contractors here, and they were secluded from the rest of the department. So there couldn't be any kind of improper influence. And in fact, TGIG, in their reply brief, concede away this argument. They say they're not bringing an undue influence challenge. So while, again, that might not be administrative best practice, I might not advise a client to do something like that, it doesn't reach the constitutional level where it has to invalidate the whole process.
Can you clarify what the status was of marijuana licensing before this process we're talking about? I just want to make sure I have a clear understanding. Short of the process that this litigation is about, is it true that anyone with a license only had a license for medical marijuana?
No, Your Honor. So my friend on the other side is correct that there was a process right at the beginning, what was called a one-for-one license, where a medical licensee could receive a retail recreational establishment license in order to get the industry kickstarted before the whole application process. So I'm not sure about the other appellants. I know that TGIG has at least one retail license because of that. But even if they had some kind of market share there, and of course, I fully join my friend's arguments that there is no standing based on market share. But even assuming there could be and they had market share, that doesn't actually mean that their revenue went down. Of course, the cannabis industry exploded in the wake of legalization. And so it's quite possible that their existing recreational licenses generated far more revenue than it would have if not for this licensing process that they disagree with. And of course,
what conditions were on those temporary licenses or provisional licenses?
My understanding is that they were not temporary, that they are still in operation.
Okay.
That they actually got a privilege as being medical licensees that other applicants didn't get.
Okay. Thank you.
And even if their revenue did decline based on the licensing process, of course, this is getting back into standing, but that's totally unrelated to the alleged flaws that they point to in the licensing process. It could have been the most perfect licensing process in the world, and the state still would have given out a lot more licenses and reduced their market share vis-a-vis the time when they were the only game in town. So that disconnect makes it, of course, the injury has to be traceable to the allegedly unlawful conduct for them to have standing. So that disconnect deprives them of standing, even if their market share theory is correct.
How long did they have this one-for-one licensing prior to the formal application process?
I'm sorry, I couldn't speak confidently with how long it was. I believe they received it in 2018, and then the licensing process finished up in December 2018, but I'm not sure exactly how long they had it for before everyone else.
Okay. And so then the process that we're discussing in this case then followed that, and then the licenses that were being issued as a result of this process were additional licenses in addition to that one-for-one process?
Yes.
And so I think you said then the folks that got that one-to-one because they previously had the medical and now got the recreational, that continued. In other words, they didn't get that taken away because they were unsuccessful in this process.
No, it was not taken away, and maybe my friends on this side can clarify, but I looked back through the currently operating licenses, and TGIG did have one, and of course they were unsuccessful in this process. So I believe that that is the same one for one that they were granted at the beginning.
And what's the difference between the one for one and the full-blown recreational?
The only difference is the one for one was given to then operating medical licensees without the competition.
I see. Understood. Thank you so much.
So to get back to the point of the relief that was granted in this case, this court has said that the district courts have, quote, full discretion to fashion and grant equitable remedies. And that should especially be the case in a case like this where the district court held a lengthy trial with live testimony that resulted in a 343-volume plaintiff's appendix. It considered all the criteria for granting equitable relief and determined that only the narrow injunction that it did grant was appropriate given the alleged flaws in the process that it found. And so we would ask this court to defer to the district court's careful consideration of the factors and reject plaintiff's invitation to reweigh the evidence, reconsider the factors, and refashion the remedy. The cannabis industry has flowered since the department issued these licenses. In fiscal year 2022, it generated almost $90 million in tax revenue for the school fund. And it would be not only enormously disruptive to the industry, but it would destroy the industry to grant the only relief that could be possible, which would be to throw out the entire licensing process and start a new one. And none of plaintiff's claims warrant that kind of relief, even if we assume that they succeed on the merits. And so we would ask that you either affirm the judgment below or dissolve the injunction and affirm the rest of the judgment.
Just one quick question. And so when you say that the remedy that they're seeking is for a redo, a do-over, would that be under the new statute and regulations that have been promulgated? Because my understanding is that NRS 453D and NAC 453D have been repealed. So are we looking at a new process? Is it the old process? I mean, what is your understanding of what would be contemplated as a remedy?
I don't think I have an understanding of what they want for a remedy. They can't be given a license from one of the winners because they've never argued that they had superior applications. So I don't know what a new licensing, whether we'd have to resurrect statutes that have been repealed or be done under the new ones. And of course, they never allege, let alone show, that they would get a license under this new system, however it is. So it seems entirely impractical and not worth the disruption and the destruction of this industry to me, but that is the only conceivable relief I could see them asking for, because like I said, we can't hand them a license. There's no damages at issue, so that would be the only thing left.
All right, thank you, Hansel.
Anyone else have any questions for Mr. Ireland? No.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. Nick Donak, may it please the court. I represent Green Therapeutics LLC, Greenleaf Farms Holding LLC, NevCan LLC, and Red Earth LLC. My clients are all licensed, qualified cultivators who joined this process as well. I'm just going to take a minute and say we join TGIT and THC's standing argument. The overall market exists, whether we know it or not. And a cultivator also sells product. Cultivator is looking for new distribution channels, presumably like medical, like retail. All of that can conceivably give competitive advantages and lead to increased market share. So we join that injury argument, causation, and redressability. Justice Lee, you were asking about the unequal communications. And our individual equal protection claim is based on that. There was a question about whether we even had that claim in our Third Amendment complaint. And we do. There is a allegation, now excuse me, in our complaint that reads, the DOT placed improper weight upon other applications simply because they were submitted by well-known and well-connected persons. Well-connected persons can have individual conversations with the leaders of the DOT. So that allegation was in there for our equal protection claim. The error that we say occurred was a misapplication of the standard.
Counsel, your time is up.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for your arguments today. We're going to go ahead and leave the bench and then reconstitute. I should have mentioned earlier, Justice Bell has recused herself from this case, which is why she wasn't on the bench, because of some dealings she had when she was still in district court on the matter. So she will not be participating in this case. So we'll go ahead and recess and then reconstitute on the next matter.